So the Jeffrey Keeler Sutta, very nice sutta, one of the simpler discourses, but very, very sweet. The title, the Jeto Keeler, Keeler of course not being killer, as in English word killer, Keeler meaning, according to the commentary, as a rigidity, rubbish, or a stump in the mind. And the other phrase it uses, Chetasa Vinibandha, is something that binds the mind, clenching it like a fist, hence the term shackle in the heart. Okay. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove in Atabhimika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus. Venerable sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus. That any bhikkhu who has not abandoned five wildernesses in the heart and has not severed five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and Vinaya, that is impossible. What bhikkhus are the five wildernesses in the heart that he has not abandoned? Here a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the teacher, and thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, and perseverance and striving. As his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, that is the first wilderness in the heart that he's not abandoned. So it's kind of case of somebody who has a doubting about the teacher, about the Buddha, and whether, of course, doubting about whether the Buddha was enlightened. And so, of course, if you are not confident in that the Buddha actually realized enlightenment, then, you know, you're not going to really put forth effort to accomplish the practice that he described for us and encouraged us to do. I remember one time there was a young monk at Bodh Nanachat, and he'd ordained just the year below me. And American monk, and turned out after he'd already done his Samanera training and started his bhikkhu training and so on, that he actually didn't really believe in Buddhism at all. And nobody had really asked him about this. We just kind of assumed, you know, that he'd kind of believed in Buddhist teachings and stuff, but he didn't really. I mean, he thought it was kind of a nice idea to be a monk and practice mindfulness and stuff, and thought the lifestyle was kind of fun and stuff, but he didn't believe in karma and rebirth, and he didn't really believe that the Buddha was enlightened and all of these kinds of things. One time I went with this monk down to stay with Ajahn Mahachachai, my metta teacher, and we were staying in this room together, and it's a very good example of this particular quality, because we were staying in this room in this meditation hall, Ajahn Mahachachai's, and we just arrived there, and we were sitting, and I remember it was quite funny, because when we arrived there, the abbot, Ajahn Chachai's, not the abbot at the monastery, but the abbot, greeted us with the classic phrase, how did it go, classic phrase, Dhamsabai Pakpon Channampana, which translates as take it easy, have a rest, and have some drinks. That's the kind of teaching that we want from the others. So anyway, so we went off and we were sitting around in the back of the hall and started talking and so on, and these issues came up and we were kind of discussing. I was very embarrassed, actually, because, you know, I was kind of, here I am, and I've come to see my metta teacher to learn about metta meditation. I was getting very annoyed with this monk who was sort of saying all these outrageous things. He didn't believe the Buddha was enlightened, and, you know, he thought it was ridiculous that we were claiming, that we were kind of Westerners, and we claimed to believe in things like rebirth and stuff, and he just couldn't even take it seriously. And he was a big fan of Richard Dawkins, and kind of just a pure materialist, secular atheist view. And I was getting a little bit wound up by this. And just as I was getting a bit wound up, the door opened and Ajahn Mahachachai walked in. Now, if you know Ajahn Mahachachai's character, he's a very, very soft, very gentle monk, and he would, every time I've been to visit him, he does exactly the same thing, which means he doesn't force or impose himself on anyone in any way, but he arranges a meeting time, and you come in for the meeting, you sit down, and you gently introduce a discussion, chat about this and that, and then he kind of gradually brings the discussion around to talking about Dhamma and meditation after he's kind of settled down and got comfortable and got relaxed. And that's how he's done every time I've been to see him over the last nearly 15 years I've been going to see him. He's done this every time. This one time he didn't do that. He walked in the back door of the hall and immediately started saying, the Buddha, he just started talking about the all-encompassing knowledge of the Buddha. And he just walked in and said, the Buddha was just full of wisdom and the epitome of wisdom, and it's not up to us to be questioning the state of wisdom that's gained by somebody like that. I thought that was a very striking teaching that he gave at that occasion. And then he gave us a talk. And what was interesting, the next bit was interesting, especially in this case, was that he gave this teaching and the other monk there asked him, what about doing lying down meditation? And he said, oh, no, it's not usually a very good idea because you tend to just lose your mindfulness and fall asleep. And he said, all right. And then he went off. Actually, we finished talking and he went off. And then my friend, because we were staying in this room together, of course, so, you know, my friend just said, oh, I'm going to try it out anyway. I'm going to try lying down meditation and see what works. This was like 8 o'clock in the evening. So 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm like, sort of venerable, you know, we've got to go for arms round. So he got up and said, oh, I guess he was right after all, you know. But that was exactly the thing, you know, he got the good advice from his teacher, but because he didn't have the faith and didn't trust in it, then just lie down and sleep all night instead of meditating. So, which is not to say that you can't sometimes do lying down meditation, but just as a rule of thumb, it tends to lead towards sleeping. So, again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the dhamma. And it's the second wilderness in the heart, jeto-kila. So, unconfident about the dhamma. So, sometimes we have doubts about particular things. We're not certain about the value of meditation. Some people come along and they say that there's no need to practice meditation. So somebody was telling me in the Sri Lankan temple on the weekend. I don't know what it is with the Sri Lankans somehow. They sometimes seem to have some strange ideas they come up with sometimes, but apparently there's one teacher in Sri Lanka saying, no, 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 you don't meditate. And all you do is sleep, apparently, and then you get to enlightenment. Anyway, and so people hear this, and then they go, oh, really? Is that what the Buddha taught? Yes, this is the Buddha's original teaching. Yes, it's been confused by all the scholars who have mixed up the Buddha's words. And really what he was talking about was the state of the formless, which is attained in the state of deep sleep. And so people hear this kind of rubbish. And, oh, really? You know? Oh, okay, maybe that's what I should be doing. Okay, well, let's try and meditate. And give up this meditation rubbish. And, of course, you know, I mean, what can you say? So one thing that, you know, we have to encourage in this context is for people to do what we're doing right now, which is to sit around, learn, study the suttas, read what the Buddha has to say, and actually find out what actually the Buddha did teach. And the only way to do that is we have to do that through a text. And it is important that, you know, we need to steer, again, a middle ground between, you know, textual literalism and fundamentalism on the one hand, which says that every word in here is literally the word that the Buddha's taught and nothing's been changed for 2,500 years. Even when there's grammatical mistakes in there, it's because of the Buddha's omniscient knowledge of how to mistake grammar in the right way or whatever. Then that's like one way of one problem. And then the other problem is just trying to make up things based on just your own preferences and ideas. It's important to understand this. If you look at any kind of intelligent or sophisticated way of approaching a text, then that will tell you that there are different perspectives on it, okay? And we all know this. We all know that different people can read different texts and they can get different takes on it. Some people maybe emphasize one aspect, some people emphasize another, some people might look at one particular part of it, one might look at another part, and we'll all come back with slightly different responses to the text. And this isn't a problem. This is part of what it means to be in a community or a living community where we're able to read something. But that doesn't mean that you can just arbitrarily read any kind of meaning whatsoever into a text. I mean, I might dispute with you about the relative importance of this particular sutra as compared to another sutra, and someone might say, well, actually this other sutra is more important for such and such reasons, or we might discuss the relationship between them, or as we're going to go on a bit later to look at the variations in the Chinese version. But that doesn't mean, as I gave the example in the Sri Lankan temple the other night, they can't read this as being a manual on how to service a 1992 Toyota Land Cruiser, okay? It's just, I just cannot do that. I can't pick this up and say the Buddha was intending to use this for us to service our 1992 Toyota Land Cruiser. This is not rational. So there becomes a point where we start to depart from anything meaningful. And one of the things that we that tells us this, or that one of the signs of this, is that language is a device invented by humans in order for the purpose of communications. I'll repeat that again. Language is something invented by humans for the purpose of communications. That's all. So the meaning of a text, the meaning of any word, is it emerges within that context of human interaction. Okay? And it doesn't mean anything outside of that. It can't mean. Language simply can't exist, or doesn't have any meaning outside of a context where humans are engaging with it, where they're reading with it, where they're chanting it, where they're reflecting on it, where they're thinking about it. This is where language comes to life. So if somebody comes up with an interpretation, which, and this is what the Buddha said, that he follows what is called loka samatha. He follows the conventions of the world. Yeah, so he didn't just arbitrarily, he had to convey some radically new teachings, but he didn't just sort of arbitrarily invent new words and new ideas and ways of putting things in order to present his teachings. He took the words and concepts and ideas that were available in his society and adapted them from his perspective and said, well, in this case, we're going to use this word in a slightly different context, you know. We're going to take this word, which is you've been seen used before in this way, and I'm going to use it in this other way in order to explain this idea. And so he's adapting and modifying, engaging in those concepts of the world. So anyone who comes along and tells you that they are receiving the true meaning of the original Tripitaka from thought waves in the cosmos, right, which some people do, then you know that this is not something we should discuss in class on textual appreciation of the suttas. It's something that we should discuss in a psychiatrist's lounge room, okay? Right? So this is what it means to be part of us and part of a human community, that we use language in order to share, to move, to share ideas that about what a text can mean and how we should interpret it. And we always remember that there are an infinite number of perspectives on a text, but that those texts, those perspectives are relatively dependent on the actual text itself. They're not completely independent. Okay? Yeah? So this is, try to overcome this doubt about the Dhamma. Okay, second one. Third one. Someone, bhikkhu, is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the Sangha. Now, this is something that is also quite relevant in discussions in our community in recent times, because of course we've had, you know, many examples where there are certainly individuals within the Sangha who are perhaps not living up to our ideal of what we think Sangha members should be doing, and we expect certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of understanding, certain kinds of intentions from Sangha members, and we don't always find it. And sometimes it's difficult, sometimes we begin to lose faith in the Sangha itself. But of course, we have to realize that there always has been a difference between a diversity of people within the Bhikkhu Sangha and Bhikkhuni Sangha. And of course, in the old days, we had our Sariputtas and Moggallanas in the Bhikkhu Sangha. We also had our Udayans and Devadattas, and of course, we had our Khemas and Upalavanas within Bhikkhuni Sangha, and we also had our Tula Nandas and her Sundari Nanda and her sisters. So the actual conventional Sangha of people who've taken ordination is of varied quality. And there's some good and there's some bad. There's some people who, you know, look like they've really got it together and they haven't got anything together. There are others that look like they're really bad and they're really sloppy, but they're actually maybe very highly attained. There are some who are having great difficulty and problems but are really sincerely trying. There's others who maybe have got a lot of accomplishments under their belt, but are slack and indolent and not practicing. So all of these people are to be found in the Sangha. And when we have our faith in the Sangha, it's not the faith in any individual Sangha member, but the faith in the idea of the Sangha and the faith in the Sangha as a whole and the institution of it. And of course, to remember the noble Sangha, the Aryan Sangha, and ultimately our faith in the Sangha is rooted in that. And in this idea that there are beings, men and women, from the time of the Buddha to the present, who have taken up the Buddha's teachings, practiced it, and actually realized those teachings, actually embodied them in their heart at a very deep level. so that it becomes like a new kind of a structure within their own consciousness, new kind of structure in their own heart. And so we have a faith that this has actually happened. Of course, the problem is actually finding out who they are. And this is sometimes a bit of a problematic one, but we just have to make educated guesses sometimes. Okay. Again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the training. So, doubtful about the training here means primarily, of course, the training sometimes is very often expressed in terms of the threefold training, sila, samadhi, panya. But when we find the training expressed by itself like this, often the emphasis is really on the training in sila. It's not to say it excludes the other kinds of training, but the emphasis often is on the training in sila and the lifestyle. And so what this really means is that bhikkhu is really uncertain about, is living in this way, is living as a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni in this way actually going to lead to where I want to go? And this is something I find very commonly here, and with people who come to stay in monasteries. And we find that this kind of attitude is unfortunately fostered by the prevalence of meditation retreats, intensive meditation retreats. And as we all know, if you go along to an intensive meditation retreat, you can experience very lovely states of consciousness within a few days. And so you think, oh, this is it, this is the way, I'm going to get to Nibbana very, very soon. And those states of consciousness, because they're not broadly based, they don't last. But people think that somehow this is what spiritual life is about, and this is what Buddhism is, and that anything else is a kind of a Mickey Mouse Buddhism, and it's not the real thing. And so when they come to a monastery like this, and they find that yes, we do emphasize and encourage meditation, but we also learn the suttas, we also study Vinaya, we also do our chores and responsibilities in the Sangha, and so on and so forth. Then some people think that there's something wrong with that, that there's something, it's not good enough, and that it's not the real thing, and that the real thing means just meditate, 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 and never do anything else. You know, of course, you never find the Buddha saying that practice is just meditate, 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 and never anything, not anything else, but that seems to be how it gets taken these days, which is a bit unfortunate. And so people who come along with those kinds of attitudes tend to have this kind of doubt about the training. They don't really believe that the training and the lifestyle of a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni is actually going to do them any good. And they think that, that they can do better by just going along to a meditation center or a retreat center and just hitting their heads against a meditation object. And they think that somehow that's going to get them enlightened. And I certainly wish them the best, and I hope that that does get them enlightened. But what I have noticed, actually, is that people who do that, and you meet them years later, and they usually don't seem any more enlightened than they were before, but that people, when they are within the Sangha, and that I've seen within the forest tradition, I don't want to make any claims about anyone having attained anything in terms of high-level states of samadhi or realization of Dhamma or anything, but if I look at the monks that I know, and I include the monks who've ordained here and the ones I was with in Thailand and so on, who've ordained in our tradition and trained and practiced with them, they just seem like, after many years, much nicer people. More mature, more responsible, kinder, more compassionate. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that's a good sign that something about the training is actually working. Although maybe it's just that they're getting older and that older people are nicer than younger people, I don't know.
Hide in the
corner. Yeah. Again, a bhikkhu is angry and displeased with his companions in the holy life. Resentful and callous towards them, and thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind is not inclined towards ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, this is the fifth wilderness in the heart that he is not abandoned. And so this one, of course, the one's relationship with one's fellows in the holy life. And of course, the opposite of this is the attitude that's found and explained very beautifully in the Chulagosinga Sutta and the Upakilesa Sutta. We've seen a little bit of that already a couple of weeks ago. We'll see some more in the Chulagosinga Wood Sutta. And that one should always have this attitude of loving kindness and compassion for one's fellows in the holy life, and take very great care to be developing this, and to just to make that like an absolute. It doesn't matter what people do, but you just don't nurse this resentment. And from time to time, it happens. From time to time, yes, we do get annoyed, we do get angry. This is life. This is normal. Okay, unless we're you know abiding in jhanas all the time, or unless we're anagamis, then we're going to experience some anger from time to time. And so this is normal, but try to let it go and try not to nurse resentment, and try not to let that fuel your own kind of actions of body and speech, so that even if you are feeling annoyed with someone, don't let that kind of influence you know, how you treat them and make you treat them in a nasty way. And certainly be very, very careful about this whole kind of revolting business of kind of ganging up and forming little factions in the monastery, so that, you know, I've got my friends and we're over here and we kind of all ganging up together. And this is the kind of thing I've seen occasionally, not with the current people at all, but in the past I've seen that, and it's a very, very horrible thing. So please keep an eye out for these, and try to really nurture this. And all I can say for myself is that the greatest example I've had for this is Ajahn Brahm. And those of you who live with Ajahn Brahm would know what a wonderful example he is of this, and how he treats his Sangha with such consideration and kindness all the time. And even when you do something naughty, you know, I remember one time we were in the rains retreat, and we had the evening drinks, and we're supposed to, in the rains retreat, it's supposed to be very strict, finish at 6-7 o'clock and go back and meditate, and that's what I did every day. But one day I got into a discussion. I went and boiled my flask of water to take back to my kuti, and I got caught in a discussion with one of the other monks who was having some problems and stuff, and we started talking, and at that time I was having very good meditation, but we were just talking and for an hour or so, and Ajahn Brahm saw the light on from his kuti, and it's like 8 o'clock at night, and he came down from his kuti. It's very embarrassing, you know. Ajahn Brahm came all the way down from his kuti to see the light was on, just to switch the light off, all right, because he didn't want to have the light left on. And he saw us talking there, and he said, you know, what are you doing? You're supposed to be back at your kuti. And I just said, oh, I was really embarrassed, and said, sorry, Ajahn, and went back to my kuti. And the next morning, I saw Ajahn Brahm again, and just apologized and asked for forgiveness from him once more. And he said, oh, what are you talking about? I've already forgotten it. And that's absolutely typical of his attitude, that he can when necessary, admonish you and tell you off, but then the next moment it's just forgotten and he doesn't carry that around. It's a very, very beautiful example to keep. So, onwards, what bhikkhus are the five shackles, Jeto Vinibandha, that he has not severed? Here a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, and craving for sensual pleasures, and thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. This is the first shackle in his heart. Again, a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, and craving for the body. Okay, so normally when we say attachment to the sensual pleasures, then of course that would include the body, which is the kind of the immediate basis for the arriving of sensual pleasure. But here they're kind of distinguished as two separate things, more specifically his body, for the body. And again, a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, and fever, and craving for form, for rupa. So here, body is kaya, form is rupa. And according to the commentary, or according to Bhikkhu Bodhi's comment here, which he doesn't say is from the commentary, but Bhikkhu Bodhi's comment is, body, kaya here means his own body, while form just below is outer forms, the bodies of others, which seems like a reasonable distinction. And so, again, a bhikkhu eats as much as he likes until his belly is full, and he indulges in the pleasures of sleeping, lolling, and drowsing. That is the fourth shackle in the heart that he has not severed. So the remedy for that is to get one of these nice little bowls, and you can't eat too much. And again, a bhikkhu lives the holy life aspiring to some order of gods. Thus, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god. And thus his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. This is the fifth shackle in the heart that he is not severed. So that's a very nice one. So the five shackles in the heart. One is sensual pleasures. Two is your own body. Three is someone else's body. Four is eating too much and sleeping it off. And the other one is, last one is going to heaven. Which I think is very cute. Bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has not abandoned these five wildernesses in the heart and severed these five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and Vinaya, that is impossible. Bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has abandoned five wildernesses in the heart and severed five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and Vinaya, that is possible. And what are the five wildernesses in the heart that he has abandoned? And of course, the reverse of the previous ones, and the five shackles in the heart that he severed, of course, the reverse of the five shackles. So the five wildernesses, one is not doubtful, one is not about the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, one is not doubtful about the training or harboring resentment and anger towards one's fellows in the holy life. And the five shackles in the heart that he has abandoned, he's free from desire for sensual pleasures, for the body, for form, for us eating and sleeping, and for becoming a god. And it then goes on to say, he develops the basis for spiritual power, consisting in concentration due to zeal and determined striving. Chanda samadhi padana sankhara samanagatang idhi padang bhaveti. He develops the basis for spiritual power, idhi, consisting in concentration due to energy and determined striving. Virya padana sankara samanagatangi dipadang bhaveti. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to purity of mind and determined striving, consciousness or chitta. Chitta sankara samana, chitta padana sankara samanagatangi dipadang bhaveti. Chitta samadhi padana sankara, sorry. Chitta samadhi padana sankara samanagatangi dipadang. So chitta, here, and then let's just read the last one. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to investigation and determined striving, and enthusiasm is the fifth. So, i.e. the fifth of the five factors here. So, these of course the four idhipadas, which are discussed in more detail in the Idhipada Sanyutta, in Sanyutta Nikaya. You can see these are one of the groups which are included within the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas and a very central group in practice of Buddhism. Just to sort of do a brief commentary on these groups, on these Dhammas, each one of them, it starts out, the first one, Chanda Samadhi. So it's Chanda, or with his Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated as zeal, which literally just means will or desire or wanting or enthusiasm. So I like to use enthusiasm for this. It says Chanda Samadhi, which is enthusiasm Samadhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated it as concentration due to zeal. In other words, his translation reflects the idea that the concentration, the samadhi, is actually produced by zeal or chanda or enthusiasm. And the reason he's done that is because that's precisely how it's explained elsewhere in the Idhipada Sanyutta. It's not something you can tell according to the grammar, but according to the explanations elsewhere. What it means is that by relying on chanda, on enthusiasm, you give rise to samadhi and one-pointedness of mind. And then this is linked up or imbued with determined striving, so padhana sankhara. So padhana, the ordinary word for striving, and sankhara, usually, of course, meaning conditions or activities or volitions in the mind, literally meaning activities, but sometimes having the meaning of energy or effort. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated sankhara here as determined striving. And this reflects the Nyanamoli's original translation, which was based on Jnanavira's idea, which was sankhara should be rendered as determinations. Okay? So here we have this kind of textual history here from Jnanavira, who developed this rather exotic interpretation of Paticca-samuppada, and in that context decided that sankharas meant determinations. Okay, so that became reflected after the conversations between Jnanavira and Jnanamoli. Then Jnanamoli put that word in his Majjhima. Bhikkhu Bodhi mostly took it out, but in occasional contexts like this one, he left it in. I can't remember what his latest one mentions it. I wouldn't use determined. I would use probably active striving. It develops the basis of spiritual power consisting in concentration due to zeal and active striving as Paddhana Sankhara. And so, in each case, the idea is you have the Iddhipada itself, the basis of psychic powers, here Chanda. Based on that, putting effort into it, you develop Samadhi. And then that Samadhi, of course, will give rise to the psychic powers, to the Iddhis. Okay, so this is the relationship between these things. So the basis for psychic power is the chanda. When that's developed through samadhi, then that will give rise to the psychic power itself, whatever that may be, flying through the air or walking on water or whatever. I'm working on the one of being able to give a Dhamma talk at the same time as being able to go back to Yakuti and have a nice little rest. But I haven't sorted that one quite out yet. So the next one, energy. So here, energy is the primary factor in developing samadhi. The third one is citta. Now, citta here just means samadhi itself, okay? Citta, when it's used in practice contexts, usually means samadhi. So you have like the adhicitta sikha, the training in the higher citta, the higher mind, which is just a term for training in samadhi. And so there's many contexts where citta, when it's used in that context of the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path, it means specifically samadhi, okay? So this is a contrast with citta and vijnana. Vijnana is not used in that context usually, although it is in some cases, like in the formless attainments, but usually not. So, and he develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to investigation. So here, investigation or inquiry is the primary factor leading to samadhi. And so again, this is showing how these things of like vipassana and samatha are interlinked and intermingled. Most of the time we emphasize the practicing, doing the tranquility and so on, leading up to attaining of samadhi. But you can also use the investigation or inquiry, and that can also lead to the attaining of samadhi. And I know some monks who have done that. For example, Ajñāna has done both ways, and he's done both straight samatha practice and also done kind of following in way of investigation. And he says that both can lead to very good results and can lead to a kind of samadhi, although it has a different kind of quality. And but his remark on the matter was that after trying both ways, he knows why most of the time people emphasize the samatha way, because the way of using investigation and inquiry to develop samadhi is extremely difficult and arduous, and involves a kind of extremely intense and sort of focused unrelenting sense of exertion in investigation for many days to be able to sort of tame the mind down to a point where it can reach samadhi. So these are the four iddhipadas. So just to say again, the basic thing to understand is that the iddhipadas themselves, enthusiasm, energy, citta or mind or consciousness, and investigation, these are things which are causal factors. They're the causes, the main causes leading to samadhi. And when that samadhi is established, then it's of course the basis for psychic power. And it should hardly need adding that the purpose of it really isn't to develop the psychic power, but the purpose of it is to develop the samadhi, which leads to liberating insight. So, a bhikkhu who thus possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. And I think I mentioned before at one time when I tried to put a passage like that on the ASA Yahoo group, and it wouldn't let me put the quote in there because it had the word bondage in there, so I said it was not appropriate. So, suppose there were a hen with 8, 10 or 12 eggs, which she had covered, incubated and nurtured properly. Even though she did not wish, oh, that my chicks might pierce their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatch out safely. Yet the chicks are capable of piercing their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatching out safely. So too, a bhikkhu who thus possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, interesting that this kind of attitude, this simile is quite interesting in a number of ways. One of the things here is that the word imbued that is used is here. I think it's translated as imbued. Yeah, covered, incubated, and nurtured properly. But the word that Yesh uses there, if I remember it correctly, is paribhavita, which is the same word that we find very frequently in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. It's also in the ordination chanting, which the monks will be learning, which talks about the imbuing, like samadhi when it's imbued samadhi when it's imbued with sila is of great fruit and great benefits. Wisdom when it's imbued with samadhi is of great fruit and great benefit. And so that word imbued is the same word that we have here in the context of the hen, which is imbuing the warmth into its eggs. So it's giving you quite a nice idea of the relationship between those different factors. And of course, the main message of this simile being that the point isn't to sort of say, oh, I want to get enlightened. I don't want to get enlightened. And so, even though in later traditions of Buddhism it became very important to making vows, that we should make a vow for this or make a vow for that and so on, the Buddha didn't talk about making vows very often. And when he did, he usually was at the best equivocal about the matter. And as you can see here, he's basically saying, well, it doesn't really make any difference. The point is, what's the causes leading to your awakening and to your breaking out of the shell? That the causes are not thinking in your mind that you want to break out of the shell. The point is the hen actually sitting on the eggs? Go and sit on the eggs. Don't make aspirations for your chicks to break out of them. Okay, and so of course also the patience of the mother hen sitting on her eggs being very much like the patience of sort of the meditator who's sitting on their meditation cushions.
Sit there for quite a long time, the chicken's dead. I don't know, when I was up on Mum's, you have this chook, and I just sat out there, and the weather was stormy for days. It was out there for about 10 days, just sitting on those eggs. It was out in the cold, the wet, the rain and stuff like that, and just kept on sitting there.
I might just briefly read through Venerable Analio's paper on this. I might the battery's about to die, and it's fairly short, so we can have some more discussion after that. But the Cetrakila Sutta treats five kinds of mental barrenness and the five mental bondages. This discourse has a Pali parallel among the tens of the Anguttara Nikaya, so one other discourse in Pali in the Anguttara, and two Chinese parallels found in the Majjhima Agama and in the Akotarika Agama. So the Akotara, which is the equivalent to the Pali Anguttara, we also find a parallel. Okay. The two Chinese versions and the Anguttara Nikaya version are slightly different in that whereas the Pali version refers only to the monks having to break out of their mental barrenness and so on, the other versions, including the Anguttara Nikaya version and the Chinese versions, all include the nuns in their treatment as well. Interesting. And all the same three versions also make it clear that these kinds of mental barrenness and mental bondage not only prevent growth, but imply actual decline. So they don't just stop you from going forward, but they actually mean you'll go backwards. Okay, rather that the Pali version has the lack of confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, the training, and one's companions in the holy life. The Majjhima Agama version speaks instead of the lack of confidence in the precepts, in the instructions, and in the fellow monks who the Buddha has praised. So instead of having the Sangha, it has the precepts. The Akotarika Agama version agrees with the Pali versions on lack of the confidence in the Sangha in one kind of mental barrenness. So this is minor variation there. The aspiration to be reborn in a heavenly realm occurs also in the two Pali versions, but the other versions qualify this kind of aspiration as a way of getting caught or being bound. This terminology places this aspiration under the heading of a mental bondage, the placing it has in the Chedokila Suttas. In addition to being found in the Pali and Chinese versions of the present discourse, the five kinds of mental barrenness occur in the Sangiti Sutta and the Dasutra Sutta and their parallels. Okay, so these two suttas, Sangiti and Dasutra, are the last two suttas in the Digha Nikaya, and they consist of a fairly lengthy collection of various kinds of dhammas, which are sort of collected and arranged according to number. And so they seem like a kind of an early predecessor or precursor to the Abhidhamma-style texts, which sort of attempt to collect and arrange a whole kind of spectrum of different teachings. Those suttas are fairly simple. They don't really try to integrate those teachings in any way. They just simply list them one after the other according to their numerical numbers, and so they've collected this grouping of the five mental barrenness. And there are many versions of these particular suttas, not just the Pali versions, also in Chinese and several versions and fragments in Sanskrit as well. The Sangiti and Dasutra suttas correspond to the presentation found in the two Chedokila suttas, in other words, to the Majjhima versions rather than the Anguttara versions. Sanskrit fragments of the Dasutra Sutra have only preserved the first and the fifth kind of mental barrenness, which are doubt in the teacher and an angry attitude to one's fellow monks, thereby agreeing with their Pali counterparts. The Chinese Dirgha Agama version of the Dasutra Sutra has the same two kinds of mental barrenness as its first and fifth, in addition to which it speaks of the lack of confidence in the Dhamma, the Sangha, and precepts. Thus, the Chinese Dasutra Sutra differs from the Pali presentations only that it speaks of confidence in the precepts instead of confidence in the training. In its exposition of such lack of confidence in the precepts, the Chinese Dasutra Sutra refers to bad and defiled conduct and to having no respect for the precepts. This suggests that one who has no confidence or respect for the precepts will quite probably not adhere to them and indulge in bad conduct. Understood in this way, this passage would offer a way of bringing together the mental barrenness found in the Pali Chedokila Suttas as lack of confidence in the training, in the Majjhima Agama version as lack of confidence in the precepts, and the Akotra Agama version as breaking one's precepts and not confessing such a breach. So despite the difference in wording, all versions would then seem to agree on the essential implications of this type of mental barrenness. So this is the point that Venerable Anālaya is making, just that there's a minor difference in the wording, but they all seem to be very similar. If you remember the point I made before when talking about the training, the sikkha, that in this kind of context, it seems to primarily refer to the training in the precepts, the training in sila. It's not to exclude the other trainings, but the main emphasis is on the training in sila. And that would seem to be corroborated by these other versions, which also mention sila in the place of the sikkha, the training there. Although, as Anālaya notes, the commentary says that the training should be understood to encompass the entire path, including training in sila, samadhi, and panya. The different presentations of the five types of mental barrenness can then be summed up as lack of confidence in the three jewels, lack of confidence in the precepts, together with its resulting bad conduct, or revolting bad conduct, however you like, and a type of attitude towards one's fellow companions in the holy life that is dominated by anger and lack of confidence. The first four of these types of mental barrenness would consequently be the direct opposites of the four limbs of stream entry, while the fifth mental barrenness would be the type of attitude that prevents a monk from being able to learn from other monks. This makes it clear why these five qualities are collected together under the heading of mental barrenness. Okay, so the four limbs of stream entry, of course, are the confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and also perfect precepts, sila. So after their exposition of the five kinds of mental barrenness, the Chedokila Suttas turn to the five mental bondages, which are desire for sensual pleasures, the body, form, overeating and overindulging in sleep, and living the holy life with the aspiration to be reborn in a heavenly realm. Being under the influence of desire for the body and for sensual pleasures recur as the first two mental bondages in the Majjhima Agama version. The same discourse continues its treatment of mental bondages by listing lack of interest in instructions pertaining to concentration and wisdom, etc., being confused and arrogant and given to excessive socialization. I'll just repeat that, just in case you missed it. Being confused and arrogant and given to excessive socialization. Does anyone require a commentary on that? being content with having attained little and making no effort to progress further. The Ekota Agama version differs considerably from the Pali and Madhyama Agama versions of the account of the five mental bondages. It agrees with the Pali versions in regard to only one of them, namely on the bondage of fondness to sleep. The other bondages in this version are to be lazy, to be without concentration, to not keep one's sense organs collected, and to prefer the market to quiet places. In addition to being found in the Chaitanya Akila Sutta and its parallels, the five types of mental barrenness occur twice as independent discourses in different parts of the Anguttara Nikaya, and notably each time followed by another discourse that treats the five mental bondages. This may not be a matter of mere coincidence, but points to an inner connection between these two sets of five. In other words, when we find these sets of five in the Anguttara Nikaya, we have these five dhammas which are disjoined in the Majjhima Sutta. In the Anguttara, they're split up in a group of five, two separate discourses dealing with the five. But these two separate discourses follow on from one another, okay? And so this points to a feature of suttas that often it's very easy to create a separate sutta. All you have to do is list the five, and then at the end you say, oh, and then the bhikkhus delighted in the Blessed One's word, right? And then you stick Evam Meh Sutang at the front of the next one, and then you've got two suttas. Before you had one sutta, and now you've got two. And so this is the kind of thing which has happened in the Anguttara Nikaya. Of course, it doesn't affect the meaning of the suttas, but it does affect the literary form in which the suttas have come down to us. So the Anguttara Nikaya version illustrates the detrimental effect of these with the imagery of the waning moon, which goes down each day in roundness, splendor, and beauty. And following comparably, the freedom from these factors is like the waxing moon that every day increases in roundness, splendor, and beauty. On the other hand, the Ekota Agama version compares it to the imagery of the egg, the hen hatching its eggs. So this simile also found in the Ekota Agama version. So that's the main similarities and differences. And as you can see, as usual in these things, we do find a few differences in wording, but they're not so much significant as in the difference in meaning, mainly just a slight difference in the exact details.
Hans, a question.
Yeah? Yeah?
It makes reference to a hen sitting on eggs.
Yeah.
And it says, even though she does not wish that the chicks might hatch, that they'll hatch anyway.
Yeah.
But then later they say, it says, you need enthusiasm in order to break out. So it's just earlier that the hen doesn't have any enthusiasm. She doesn't really care. She's just doing the job.
That's not what it's really implying. It's implying like the actual formulation of the explicit thought. May they break out. Okay? So she has the wish that they break out, but she's just sitting there, that's all she's doing. But is she actually saying to herself, is she sitting there saying to herself, may they break out, may they break out, and that's not going to make any difference. Yeah? That's the point. It's specifically about this thing of like making a vow. Yeah? But that's not to deny also that making a vow can't sometimes be useful for bringing up those factors. So if making a vow is going to help you to get more enthusiasm and all those things, then that's fine. But the point is, it's not simply the act of making the vow. That's part of the whole Indic spiritual tradition where the idea of making a vow was considered to be very important. And you'd make some kind of determination or resolution, and that was felt that in itself would accomplish the aim.
My other question would be enthusiasm, determination, and striving. Striving to be in a different state than the current state that you're in, which is desire and not contentment, not being content with the present moment as things are.
Yep.
It's a desire to be different, to change, and so I just have a little bit of a conflict.
That's part of the
meditation is about appreciating the present moment, like staying with the breath, which is the present moment.
Yeah. But again, you have to want to stay with the breath, don't you?
Yes, that's right.
I mean, if you don't want to meditate, you don't want to stay with the breath, then you wouldn't do it. You just roll over and go to sleep. Yeah? So I mean, the point is that the second noble truth, truth of craving, is that that craving which is bound up with rebirth. Okay, not doesn't mean any old desire. It means specifically those desires that are unwholesome and which lead to suffering. Whereas this kind of desire leads to unbinding of suffering, and hence is wholesome. Actually, somebody asked the Dalai Lama that at the talk, and they asked him about ambition. And they said, is ambition something good? And he said, well, it depends on what you're ambitious for. You know, and if you want to be ambitious, what was the example he gave?
Something like ambition for Buddhahood.
Yeah, he said, well, you know, in our tradition, we want to be the Buddha. He said, that's the biggest ambition you could want, you know. But it's entirely wholesome and only has good results. Yeah, so this just makes that distinction. Another way of looking at it, Venerable Ananda was asked that question specifically in that context of these four Iddhipadas. It's an Iddhipada Samyutta, because it has one of them is chanda, which literally means desire, and normally used just to mean, it's the most general word in Pali to mean desire. And they asked, hang on, what are you talking about? And he said, well, it's like if you want to go to the park. You know, you have this desire to go to the park, yeah, right? Okay, so then you're walking there. While you're walking there, you have the desire to go to the park. Yes, that's true. When you've actually arrived at the park, do you still have the desire to go to the park? You say, well, no, of course not. You're already there. Why would you have that desire? That previous desire you had, it's gone now. It's accomplished its purpose. Yeah.
As Martha mentioned, the Buddha's come at the first step of four, the 37 practice of the
Bodhipakkhya, yeah.
So really, it has to be there.
Yeah, yeah, have to have that, yeah.
And what is some relevance about the discourse in the sixes of Anguttara?
Uh-huh.
About you don't have to make an intention when you practice.
Oh, that's right, yeah, yeah.
So that sounds
similar, isn't it? Yeah, the same idea that it's about the natural flow of conditions, not about...
It doesn't have to wish the yeah. produce.
Yeah, yeah.
We produce anyway.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm sure the hens in the battery farms don't wish, oh, may I produce an egg.
Yeah, they're probably wishing, oh, may
but,
I. Well, I guess if they don't, they'll probably have their heads chopped off. So.
But the hen knows that the hen must sit on the eggs for that result to occur. Mm-hmm. And the hen doesn't go walking off the chain to the other hens.
Mm.
Because it's gonna, the eggs will get cold and they won't hatch.
Mm.
So she knows she's going to sit there.
Mm. Yeah. It's the same when you're practicing, you know that you're practicing for enlightenment. You know, I'm meditating because I want to purify the mind and I want to get enlightened. You know, kind of fool yourself about that. There's no kind of, you don't have to play any mind games with yourself and say I'm going to kind of sneak up behind myself and not be wanting to meditate when in fact I am. You just do it, you just be normal about it. But you understand that desire is in itself is limited. You reach enlightenment and that desire is gone. But also it progressively transcends itself in your meditation itself. As you meditate, the more you meditate, the more subtle your whole mind gets, and so the more subtle your desire becomes. And so once you've got even a little bit into your meditation, you'll start to see that if you have that kind of wanting mind that's always reaching out into the future, then that'll stuff up your meditation. You know, and so that you still have a kind of desire there, but it's refining itself as you keep going, and it's always kind of checking itself and feeding back on itself. And together with that whole refinement of consciousness, the refinement of desire is also there. But it was always a problem, at least until you get into samadhi. You know, it's always a problem because you're either pushing too hard or else pulling back too much. One or the other.
Also, Bhante, the four Cheta Thilas are identical out of the five. First, and in the Kassapa Samhita, where Lord Buddha and Great Kassapa discuss in the future, the Dhamma will.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The decline of the Dhamma. Yeah.
And the fifth one also maybe concentration. You can't
concentration, yeah.
You don't have anger.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's finish by paying respect.
Naram samma sambuddho bhagava buddham bhagavantam abhivade svakato bhagavata dhammo Dhammam namassam. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namo.